It is now my pleasing duty, brothers and sisters, to invite our brother Jim Carey to guide our hearts and minds aright with the words of exhortation.
Presiding brother and my beloved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ, we bring with us the loving and fraternal greetings of your brethren and sisters at both the Enfield and Golden Grove Ecclesias. We come, brethren and sisters, this morning to put forth our hand once again for the partaking of bread and wine. It is a solemn occasion when we come to allow the word of our God to explore the inner recesses of our minds, to lay ourselves bare in the presence of our Heavenly Father, brethren and sisters, that we might leave this place cleansed from our sin. Our readings in the Old Testament have brought us to Judges 2 and 3, which would have been a very appropriate reading for the purposes of exhortation this morning, and we were intending at one stage to consider those two chapters, although when we were last here in this country we did speak of them on several occasions, and so we felt it might be perhaps more useful on this occasion to do something that we haven't done in this country before. To look at the 30th chapter of Proverbs. It is a remarkable chapter, brethren and sisters, and you will see when we go through this chapter, in fact you'll hear some loud echoes that we pick up in the reading of the Epistle of James. In fact, the reading this morning has many of the ideas lifted out of the book of Proverbs, some from this chapter. So in this 30th chapter of Proverbs, we have the sixth part of the book, compiled, of course, by the wisest of all men, apart from one. A man, brethren and sisters, who had learnt by the bitter experiences of life and the application of the principles of the wisdom that Yahweh gave him, what life in the truth was all about. And that is, in fact, what he gives to us in this 30th chapter of Proverbs. The result of the harvest of his life. And it's a chapter which, on first reading, doesn't seem, I say on first reading, it doesn't seem to have any theme. It just seems as though there are many ideas written down. But that is not the case, brothers and sisters. There is a marvellous theme in this 30th chapter of Proverbs that we shall see. As we would expect, I suppose, from any scripture, there's always a theme there. And it's a theme that digs very deeply into each one of us, especially, I think, for those of us who have been in the truth for some while. Because what we have here are the words of a man who calls himself Agur, the son of Jacob. That's the beginning of what really is, to many, an inscrutable chapter. Of all the writings of Solomon, perhaps apart from his song, the 30th chapter of Proverbs is the most inscrutable. He even seeks to hide himself behind a pseudonym. He chooses the nom de plume, Agur, the son of Jacob. And the reason he does that, brothers and sisters, he doesn't want us necessarily to look at Solomon. He wants us to look at him as a representative of ourselves. That you and I might see that the experiences that he went through and the things that he harvested from life in the truth is exactly what you and I will find as we go through our lives in the truth and we get towards the end of our probation. We will discover that the things that he learned by experience, sometimes bitter, are the same things that we all have to go through in order to attain to the wisdom that leads us into the presence of the Father. That's where Solomon sought to go. We shall see this morning. It's an extremely interesting, and sometimes, I suppose you could say, it's an exciting chapter. When you see the way in which it is structured. Well, let's just ascertain, first of all, what he's driving at. We can find that out from verse 1. It is the words of Agur, the son of Jacob. Agur means the gatherer. Comes from the Hebrew root agar, which means to harvest. So here is a man who presents himself as a harvester, a gatherer. He's the son, the word ben means a family builder, the family builder of Jacob, which means an obedient one. So the harvester of the experiences of life is going to set down, brothers and sisters, the principles by which the family of an obedient one can be built. And we're all in that family. However, it is a prophecy, not a prophecy in the sense of prophesying the future. The word means a burden or an oracle. It's a burden, brethren and sisters, because we've all got to carry this through our life. And Solomon carried it. The word of his God had placed upon him a burden. He's about to give us the benefit of that burden as he understood it. He's going to speak words that he's harvested from life as he has attempted to build the family of an obedient one. He describes himself then at the end of verse 1 as the man that spake unto Ithiel, even unto Ithiel and Eucal. Strange language indeed, isn't it? The word man there is the Hebrew word geba. We will meet that word again later on in this chapter in verse 19. Geber, of course, is not the common word for man. It's related to gibor. It means an experienced man. A warrior. Someone who has been through a lot of difficult experiences and has learnt by them. So here he is, the harvester, who's an experienced man who can speak unto Ithiel and unto Eucal. Ithiel means, brothers and sisters, ale is with me. And Eucal means I shall prevail, according to the Oxford Dictionary of Biblical Names. So here we've got the experienced man who could speak from the perspective of one who had come to understand that ale was with him, and because of it, he would prevail. Now you will see that that is exactly how this chapter unfolds. As we go through it step by step, it won't be in great detail, but we'll have sufficient time to demonstrate that the principles he expresses in verse 1 will flow through this chapter. Now the chapter itself is of a remarkable construction. Verses 1 to 6 are the burden of the gatherer. In that section he deals with the experiences that he's learnt through his long life in the application of the principles of the truth. In verses 7 to 10, he makes two requests, two essential requests of his God before his probation ends. And then we have, brethren and sisters, six groups of four. They start in verse 11 through to verse 14 with four wicked generations. Then in verses 15 to 17, we have four insatiable things. In verses 18 to 20, there are four untraceable things. In verses 21 to 23, there are four intolerable situations. In verses 24 to 28, he speaks of four creatures that are little, but very wise. Then our final group of four is in verses 29 to 31. There are four things which excel in motion. And then finally, in the last two verses, verses 32 and 33, there is a warning against self-justification. The structure of the last half of this chapter is quite remarkable. We shall say a little more about that when we get down to verse 11. And you will see that there is a reason why there are six groups of four, and you'll be able to see that the fifth group of those six is quite different than all the rest. There's a reason for that, as we shall also see in a moment. Let's then come back to the first six verses of this chapter. We've read verse 1. Here's the man who's harvested from life. He's learnt that it's only through ale that he is able to prevail. And then, brothers and sisters, in verse 2, he says, surely I am more brutish than any man, and have not the understanding of a man. Now the word brutish means to eat food like an animal. It actually means to be like a beast. I am more like a beast, he says, than any man. Now this word man is Ish. And the next word man in verse 2 is the word Adam. So already we've met three different words that have been translated by man. He says, I am more like a beast than the whole human race. Because you see, Ish and Adam are contrasted. You need proof of that. You can have a look at Psalm 49 verse 2 and you will find that the psalmist speaks of rich and poor and low and high. And the words for low and high are Bene Adam and Bene Ish. Same thing applies in Psalm 69. So when you have those two Hebrew words, Ish and Adam, used in the same passage, they are meant to contrast the two ends of the spectrum of the human race. Those who are high and those who are low. So Solomon says, brothers and sisters, that the one thing he has learned out of life is that he is a beast. The rest of the human race doesn't know that. It's only those who know the secrets that he's learned that know that. They think themselves to be mighty. And from the mighty to the low, they don't know what they are, but Solomon has learned what he is. I'm a beast. He's come to understand how his nature operates, brothers and sisters. He's going to talk quite a lot about that in this chapter. So he says, I've not even up to the understanding of an Adam. They don't even know what they are, but I do. In verse 3, I neither learned wisdom. You don't need to learn the wisdom of the world to know what he understood about himself. That wisdom comes from somewhere else. And that's why he then says, yet, and I'll give you the correct translation, yet the knowledge of holy ones I know. The whole human race doesn't know what they are, but I know what I am. And I've come to know that because I have the knowledge of holy ones. And he mentions those holy ones in verse 4. Who hath ascended up into heaven or descended? Who hath gathered the wind in his fists? He's asking questions that have got obvious answers. Who hath bound the waters in a garment? Who hath established all the ends of the earth? What is his Shem, his name? It refers, of course, to Yahweh's character. What is his name? And what is his son's name? And I'll give you the correct translation. Surely you know. Surely you know, he says. I've got the knowledge of holy ones. And I know who they are. I know the name. And I know his son's name. He's the obedient one, brothers and sisters. And here was a harvester of the experiences of life who was determined to build the family of holy ones. The obedient one. And he looked to him to do a marvelous work, which we remember here this day. You see what he's saying in verses 2 to 4, brothers and sisters, is this. That the closer we get to our Father, and the greater he becomes in our estimation, the more wretched our own state appears. The more we see ourselves for what we really are. And like the Apostle Paul, brothers and sisters, when we stand in the presence of our God, we declare ourselves to be wretched. Oh, wretched man that I am. Who shall deliver me from this body of death? That's our response, isn't it? But the rest of the world goes on its way and carries on as though they themselves were God. They don't know that they're beasts. But the wisdom that has been learnt from holy ones has brought us to this place this morning, has it not? We know our need, and we are here to satisfy that need. And you know, Solomon learnt this from a source that you and I know is the only source from which it can come. That's why he says in verse 5, every word of Eloah, the mighty one. You see, he's one of the holy ones. Every word of Eloah is pure. The word means to fuse metal by fire, to test by fire. And you know what he's saying, brothers and sisters? He's saying that he has proven, and this is what he's harvested from life, he has proven by trial, and sometimes error, that God is right. You can have your own opinions. You can go your own way. But the bitterness of experience in life will teach you that God is right. Every word of the Mighty One is pure, it's tested. And therefore he is a shield unto them that put their trust in him. The word shield, Magin, means a small shield, which you can only use effectively by keeping it close to your body. It needs to be moved to be useful. It's got to be active. But it's a protection against the fiery darts of the wicked. So every word of God is tested and pure. He is a shield to them that are seekers of refuge in him, as that could be rendered. Solomon has learnt that, brethren and sisters. And he's also learnt something else in the process. Verse 6. Add thou not unto his word, lest he reprove thee, and thou be found a liar. For it is human nature, brethren and sisters, to always fly to its own defence. And sometimes we add to God's word in our own defence. We will justify our own cause. We will find a passage in the Bible that proves to ourselves at least, even if to nobody else, that what we are doing is right, when in fact it is despicable in the eyes of our God. And Solomon had learnt, brethren and sisters, that human nature is so bestial, it is so deceptive, it is so sick, to use the words of Jeremiah, so deceitful above all things, can't ever allow it to seek justification. And as soon as your nature begins to justify itself, you're in trouble. And that's why, you see, he says, I've learnt this by bitterness, that you must not add unto his words, lest he reprove thee and thou be found a liar. Live in times when self-justification, as it was in the days of Judges, is the greatest problem confronting the brotherhood of Christ. And you can go around the world, brothers and sisters, and you will find people that can justify almost anything from the Bible. Doing it in the days of Judges, weren't they? Every man did right in his own eyes. That was the spirit of the times. They could prove that they were right in their own eyes. Here's the wise man telling us that the end product of his harvesting was you're wasting your time because you'll be convicted and found false. Then he comes to his two essential requests. He says in verse 7, two things have I required of thee. You see, he really wanted these things, brethren and sisters. It wasn't just something that occurred to him. He says, deny me not then before I die. He was reaching towards the end of his probation. And he wanted to achieve this. I want two things only. And look at them. Verse 8. Remove far from me vanity and lies. They're basically the same things. The word vanity there is the word shah. It means falsehood or guile. occurs in Exodus 20 in verse 7, translated vain. You should not take the name of Yahweh thy God in vain, or falsely, or in guile. And the word lies is the Hebrew word kasab, which means falsehood, or a lie. Literally, in fact, in the Hebrew, it is the word of a lie. So basically, it's the same thing. If you had to use one English word to describe what he's talking about, you would say that Solomon, the harvester, is asking to be free of hypocrisy. He wants to be free of duplicity, falseness, showing one face to the brethren and another face to the world, of practicing in public, at least evidently, what is right, but privately practicing corruption. That's what he's asking to be free of, brothers and sisters. And you and I know by experience, don't we, that it's extremely difficult to be absolutely single in our approach to the truth, to be consistent when we're in private, before our God only, with all the things that we would do when we're in the sight of our brethren. It's extremely difficult to get to a point in life, brethren and sisters, where it doesn't matter whether you're here with the brethren or alone on a hillside with your God, that you're exactly the same. That's what he's asking for. Please, I want two things before I die. I want to be free from hypocrisy. It's the greatest struggle of my life. And of yours. Then he comes to the next one. In verse 8. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food convenient for me. You'll notice the margin. Sufficient. An allowance. That's all that I need. Lest I be full and deny thee. The word means to be untrue. Facts rendered elsewhere, dissembled. You see, it's still on the same basic theme, the theme of hypocrisy. Well, lest, he says, I be poor and steal, and do violence to the name, to give the actual Hebrew, to do violence to the name. For there are two opposite ends of the scale, aren't there? There is such fullness that a man begins to think that he owns the world, virtually. That all that he's got is really his. And there are those who are so poor that they're always looking to take that which is not theirs. And most of us are somewhere in the middle of that scale, brothers and sisters. But what the wise man was saying was this. What I want to achieve before the end of my life is that godly contentment that the apostle speaks of in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 6 to 8, when he says, godliness with contentment is great gain. We brought nothing into this world, we shall carry nothing out. And having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. And you know what, brothers and sisters, I don't see so much of it in this country, but I see it in my own country. We are right on the verge of the return of Christ. We're living in the year 1992, and we have got absolutely scores of people in our country who are buying and selling homes as they're going out of fashion and upgrading in difficult economic times, when it requires you to have two people in the house working in order to pay the mortgage and to maintain your standard of living. That's happening in our country. I don't know about this country. Doesn't matter. But it tells me something, brothers and sisters. We, and I mean most of us, are not content with such things as we have. We are not content. So there are two essential requests that the wise man wants. before he dies. He wants to have that truthful simplicity that will see the end of hypocrisy and duplicity in his life. And he wants to have that godly contentment that will see him, brothers and sisters, simply accept what he's got and live out his life in full service to his God without any hindrance to that service. Is that where we're heading? By the end of our lives, brothers and sisters, we will reach the same conclusion as the wise man, that there's no point in heading anywhere else. And then he adds another verse, verse 10. Accused not a servant unto his master, lest he curse thee and thou be found guilty. Why would he pop that in there? Well, you see, brothers and sisters, he knows all about human nature. And he knows that when we talk about these things, we automatically look that way and that way, to the brother or the sister alongside us. I bet they're listening. This message is really for them. The wise man is talking about what he harvested for himself. And he says, brethren and sisters, I learned how my nature operates. That when these lessons were brought home to me, my automatic reaction was to say, well, that message is for brother so-and-so. Accuse not a servant to his master, lest he curse thee and thou be found guilty. One of his requests was that he should be free from hypocrisy. And you know, our automatic reaction is to think of someone else, which takes the pressure off ourselves, doesn't it? Keep the pressure on yourself. That's what he's saying. So you see, he's brought us to a certain point in this chapter where he has laid before us what he's harvested from life. And now he comes to his six groups of four. And the first group of four, from verses 11 to 14, brothers and sisters, is the foundation of all the subsequent groups, or at least four of the subsequent groups. You see, in verse 11, we have the words, there is a generation. And you'll find them repeated in verse 12, 13, and 14. Now each of the generations referred to spell out something that the wise man had observed. This is what he's harvested from life. He's observed the behaviour of human nature. He's seen it operating in other people. And then he's come back to himself and said, well, that's how my nature operates. And I am going to avoid these things. I want to be free from these things. So we would do well just to try and understand the way in which his mind was operating when he recorded these things. And if we can see what he was driving at, then we will have the same comprehension of the way our nature operates as that which he observed. You see, when he says in verse 11, there is a generation that curseth their father and doth not bless their mother, he's talking about disobedience, isn't he? That's the principle. Disobedience. Now that's spelled out in the next group of four. It's amplified in verses 15 to 17. I want you to notice the structure here. You need proof of that. You can just cast your eye across to verse 17. The eye that mocketh at his father and despiseth to obey his mother, the ravens of the valley shall pick it out, and the young eagles shall eat it. That's the result of those who curse their father and do not bless their mother. So you see, now our structure begins to take shape. Verse 11 is amplified in verses 15 to 17. The subject matter is disobedience. Verse 12, he speaks about hypocrisy. That's amplified in verses 18 to 20. You'll see when we get there that the subject matter of that section is hypocrisy. Verse 13 is about pride, human pride. That's amplified in verses 21 to 23. Verse 14 is about oppression. The oppression of the strong over the week. That is amplified for us in verses 29 to 31. Now you will see, brothers and sisters, that I've leapfrogged a section of verses. I've leapfrogged verses 24 to 28. And the Spirit indicates that that's the way it should be done. Because you see, when you come to look at the beginning of each of those sections that amplify verses 11 to 14, they all begin with the words, yea, there are three things, yea, four. Have a look at verse 15, for instance, in the second sentence. There are three things that are never satisfied, yea, four. Have a look at verse 18. There be three things which are too wonderful for me, yea, four, which I know not. Again in verse 21. For three things the earth is disquieted, and for four. Verse 29. There be three things which go well, yea, four. Now that is a fairly common, when I say common, it's used in the prophets. It's very common in Amos, for instance. Three things, yea, four. For instance, in Amos 1, verse 3, 6, 9, 11, and 13, you will find that Yahweh says, for three transgressions of Judah or Moab or Edom, whatever it might be in that particular verse, for three transgressions of Judah, and for four, I will not pardon the iniquity thereof. Three is the number of completion, bringing a result. Four, of course, extends it. And what that is saying is that it's sufficient and more than enough. So the wise man's going to talk about his observations of the things that were going on around him, which are sufficient and more than enough to illustrate the principle. But there's a difference, you see, when you come to verse 24. It doesn't say three things, yea, four. It says there be four things which are little upon the earth. Four is the number, which we pointed out last night, of divine order of righteousness. Perfect ecclesia is a cube. Israel's encampment was four square. Breastplate was four square. Righteousness. We're going to see that the little creatures that are mentioned in verses 24 to 28, in what constitutes the fifth group, get this, the fifth group, the group of grace, are the antithesis of the generations of verses 11 to 14. You see, this is the sixth part of Proverbs. And he's going to be talking about what he's observed in man. That's why there are six groups of four. But the fifth is the group of grace. Well, let's just see if we can ascertain what this section here is driving at. As I said, verse 11 is amplified in verses 15 to 17. The subject matter is disobedience. When you look very carefully at verses 15 to 17, it's talking about those things that have relationship to life and death, to procreation, to the generation of the race. And this is where the problem comes from, isn't it? The problem comes from the production of people. Every new baby that's born is brought into the environment where evil dominates. And as they grow, their nature, brethren and sisters, is intrinsically evil and produces, in common with those around them, sin. Hence, of course, the laws of uncleanness under the law of Moses to emphasize that fact. So he's going to be talking about things to do with the generation of man. There's a generation that curseth their father and doth not bless their mother. Have a look at verse 15. The horse leech hath two daughters. A horse leech is a blood-sucking creature. Something that sucks blood out of you. You suck enough blood out of yourself and you're dead. That's exactly what sin is. our nature contrives to take away our life. We are identified, brothers and sisters, from the day of our birth with death. We are destined to die. This horseleech has got two daughters, and they've both got the same name. You can cross out the word saying in your Bible, it's not there. Or crying, should I say. The word crying is not there. These two daughters have got the same name. Give, give. And that's our nature, isn't it? Give, give. It's never satisfied. It's always demanding more. Give, give. There are three things, he says, that are never satisfied. Here are these four insatiable things. They're never satisfied. They four things say not, it is sufficiency. What are they? The grave and the barren womb and the earth that is not filled with water. Production of millions upon millions of people, all made from the same stuff. The angels mingled water with the dust of the ground and they made clay. The earth is not filled with water. And the fire, the symbol of divine judgment, never says, it is enough. He lieth mocketh with his father, and despiseth to obey his mother. The ravens of the valley shall pick it out. The eye is a symbol of intelligence. And the only way to escape, brothers and sisters, from the destiny of all men, is to have your mind, your intelligence, change into the obedience to father and mother, which leads us to the obedience of holy ones. The wise men have learned that. Your intelligence is not changed and you despise father and mother, he says. The ravens will pick it out. He was a man who had learned, as he'd observed humanity around him, that there was a way of escape, but not many men took it. The next generation, verse 12, are pure in their own eyes, and yet is not washed from their filthiness. This is spelled out in verses 18 to 20. Now this will come as a bit of a shock to some of you, because this is not the way that this passage is normally understood. You see, the subject matter of verse 12 is hypocrisy, isn't it? They're pure in their own eyes, but they're not washed from their filthiness. They've hidden it. And that's the subject matter of verses 18 to 20. Four untraceable things. There be three things which are too wonderful. He doesn't mean wonderful in the sense of great. He means it's difficult to discern. Yea, four which I know not. The way of an eagle in the air, and the way of a serpent upon a rock, and the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. All of them, brothers and sisters, all of them are hunters. That's their common denominator. And all of them are untraceable in their activity. Why does the eagle circle in the air and go round and round and round? What is the purpose of that if it's not for hunting? And when the prey is seen and the eagle falls upon it, brothers and sisters, and takes the victim away to its lair, you can't look there and say, well, it went there, and then it went there, and then it went there, and then it went down there. You can't see where it's been. But it's got the victim in its lair. And the way of a serpent upon a rock. We have snakes in our country, many of them, and they hunt for victims. Snakes don't like rocks. They don't go on the rocks unless they have to. But they go on the rocks to find the rodents, which are their diet. And when they've caught the victim and taken it away to their hole, you can't go to the rock and say, well, I think he went there, and then he went there, because it's gone. It's untraceable that the victim is dead. And the way of a ship in the midst of the sea. In those days, ships were used for warfare, or for trading, or for piracy, and all of them are a form of hunting. And as the ships plied the sea, brothers and sisters, for those purposes, and they found their victims and went home to their home port, you couldn't go out on a boat and say, well, they went here, because the waves of the ocean have destroyed the evidence of the course of that ship. Such is hypocrisy. You don't know where I've been this week, do you? Or maybe you might have some idea. But you don't know what I was doing. I don't know where you've been. But we're all here this morning. We're in our home port. You see, he's talking about the activity of hypocrites. How do we know that? And look at verse 20. Four times he's used the term the way. Such is the way of an adulterous woman. She eateth but wipeth her mouth and saith, I've never done any wickedness. No problem in my life. You know, when you eat something, you usually leave the evidence around your mouth. And you wipe it away. She takes her fill and says, well, you can't see any evidence, can you? It's gone. There is a generation that are pure in their own eyes, and yet is not washed from their filthiness. Deliver me from hypocrisy. Can you see why I ended up with that conclusion? You see why I want to make that essential request? Then it comes the next one, verse 13. We'll go through these very quickly now. Verse 13. There's a generation, how lofty are their eyes, and their eyelids lifted up. This is pride, human pride. Have a look at it in verse 21. There are three things for which the earth, he says, is disquieted. It quivers, and there are four which it cannot bear up under. For a servant, when he reigneth, a man who is a slave who becomes a king, he can't handle his pride. And a fool when he is filled with meat, a man who won't work to keep his own. He's an infidel, yet his table is full of all the good things of life. He's filled with pride, like the people who go out and put their hand out for the dole. And the government gives them more money for staying home and doing nothing than working. And they're filled with pride. They think that they own the world. Lay on the beaches in Australia. Have a great life. They're filled with pride. For an odious woman when she is married. A woman that no one wanted ends up being married. She can't handle her pride. And her handmaid that is heir to a mistress like Hagar, she had to be cast out because of her pride. And then he comes in verse 29 to the fourth group. Of verse 14, the oppressors whose teeth are as swords and their jaw teeth as knives. Devour the poor from off the earth and the needy from among men. Look at them. Verse 29. There be three things which go well. It means going well in a march. They're going forth for warfare. Yea, four are comely in going. A lion that is strongest among beasts and turneth not away for any. He's not afraid of anybody. He's got the power to oppress whomsoever he will, and he uses it. A greyhound, the word actually means a war horse. A war horse who loves the scent of battle and warfare. He's pouring at the ground to get into the fight. Not afraid of anyone. A he-goat that will butt and kick. And a king against whom there is no rising up. These are the oppressors amongst men, brothers and sisters, who have got power and who use it against those who are weak. And Solomon observed that. You see, there is a nexus between these things. When you start off on the wrong foot, disobedience becomes your problem. And you despise father and mother. The next step is hypocrisy. And I've seen that. Inside the brotherhood. When there's despising of father and mother and the values for which they stand, the next thing is you get a generation of people who will sit in the hall, but in private, they'll practice their own things. And they're filled with pride. And they're also oppressors. Solomon said that. But there is a different class. Verse 24. There be four things which are little upon the earth, but they are exceeding wise. The word means the wise ones of those made wise. It's Yahweh who's given them this wisdom, not come from themselves. The ants are a people not strong. I want you to notice the use of this language. You see, they're all conscious of their weakness and vulnerability, these four little things. They all know they are weak. You see, that's verse 2, isn't it? I've come to the conclusion that I'm weak. I'm a beast. The ants are a people not strong, yet they prepare their food in the summer. They use the opportunities given. You see, that's the principle of diligence, isn't it? Diligent use of opportunity. Verse 26, the conies are but a feeble folk, yet they make their houses in the rocks. They know that they've got limitations, that they need the security of the rock. That's humility. These are the antithetical principles, I should say, to disobedience, hypocrisy, pride, and oppression. The locusts have no leader. Yet they all go forth, all of them by bands, and it seems as though someone's controlling them because they're all, as it were, obedient. Verse 28, the spider, it shouldn't be the spider, it should be the gecko, it's a lizard. The gecko can be taken with the hands, that's how it should be rendered. We've got them in Australia, they come inside the house, they're harmless little lizard, about that long. You pick them up by the tail drops off. That's their protection, their only protection. The bird gets them by the tail, it drops off, and they fall to the ground and run into some house or rock or whatever for protection. The tail grows again. But they're harmless little lizards, and you pick them up. You can take them in your hand. They'll do you no harm. They're vulnerable, and they know it. That's why they go into the house. And they're in king's palaces. And they stay inside the house. They know that's where their security is. So here's a generation, brothers and sisters, that's quite different. They're the antithesis to the four generations of verses 11 to 14. But having said all of that, brothers and sisters, Solomon's got two verses to add. And he comes to verse 32 and he says, all right, you've heard what I've said. You've seen what I've harvested from life. I've given you my experiences and my observations. I'm telling you that I've learnt these lessons. And now I want to lay down just two more things. I'll tell you, it's in fact one. It's a warning against self-justification. If thou hast done foolishly in lifting up thyself, or if thou hast thought evil, lay thine hand upon thy mouth. Keep your mouth closed. He's referring back to verse 6, isn't he? Act thou not unto his words, lest he reprove thee. And when, brothers and sisters, the sword of the Spirit goes straight through us, then we ought to accept that and say, well, it's right. Every word of God is pure. He is a shield to them that seek refuge in him. We shouldn't add to his words. If we've done foolishly, and there's not one of us that doesn't fit that category, then let's lay our hand upon our mouth in his presence. Don't seek to add to his words and to justify ourselves. We're here to lay ourselves bare this morning, and we ought to do that. Because you see, he says in verse 33, surely the churning of milk bringeth forth butter. You mix milk long enough, you'll get butter. And the wringing of the nose bringeth forth blood. You get out of someone's nose and tweak it, you'll get blood. No question about that. So the forcing of wrath bringeth forth strife. If we come to the table, brothers and sisters, and we tell our God, look, I'm going to go my own way. I'm going to do this and do that, and I'm not really controlled. Which we would never do openly, would we? We'd never do that in so many words. But if we're defending ourselves, we may as well, as it were, take God by the nose. That's what he's saying. That's hideous, ridiculous. But that's what men do when they defend themselves in the face of his principles. So as we reach forth the bread of life, brothers and sisters, let us remember the words of the harvester, the family builder, of an obedient one.